Okay, I don't know that I remember what verse we stopped last time.
We just did the first angel.
Yeah. We're ready for verse 8.
Did we actually spend the whole time on 6 and 7?
Yeah.
I believe so.
Imagine that. That's really not surprising for us, but it's a little short. Okay, Bill's not here to read. Who would like to read?
I can read. Do you want 8 through what, Jean?
Through the second angel, so that would be through 9.
Okay. Okay, this is Free Bible Version, verses 8 and 9 of Revelation 8. The second angel blew his trumpet. Something looking like a huge mountain of flaming fire was thrown into the sea. One third of the sea turned to blood, and one third of the creatures that lived in the sea died, and one third of all ships were destroyed.
Okay. When I see a mountain, I think of the Northwest Semitic version. This is not Mesopotamian now. Mesopotamians didn't have mountains, except in the distant, they had the Zagros Mountains and the Urartu Mountains, but the Urartu Mountains were really closer to Hatti land. And the Zagros Mountains were just beyond Mesopotamia. But when I hear mountain, I think of, in the Northwest Semitic peoples, mountains were where the gods dwelt. So a mountain was a divine place of abode. Now, whether that plays a role here or not, I don't know. But I just thought I'd put that out there. The great mountain was burning with fire, was thrown into the sea. That would be, from our perspective, that would likely be a volcano. I don't know, have any of you ever read a book by, I'm trying to think, she was a very famous Adventist writer who published lots of books, Norma Youngberg. Book. It was on the story of a missionary family. This happened, I think, in the 1800s. They went to Borneo, some of the islands around Borneo, near Sanger. And they went to this one little island. And of course, the witch doctor had it in for them. He did not want them on his island. And he tried to kill the little girl that they had. With poison. He tried to place a curse on them. And there was this mountain in the ocean of this island that was a volcano, and it had gotten active. It was spewing out fire and smoke. And one of the chief's son adopted Christianity. He was a young boy. And he decided he wanted to follow Jesus. And that, of course, made the witch doctor furious. And so they brought some Muslims to the island to try to re-educate. They would rather have a Muslim because they wouldn't do away with their animism and all of that. So they did that. And the Muslim said, you got to get rid of this boy. And they decided to offer him as a human sacrifice to the fire god on this mountain. And the mountain was ready to blow up. So they rode out to the mountain and they threw him on the sand. And when he didn't come to worship that night, the missionary knew something bad had happened. And the chief's son, no, it wasn't the chief's son. His own son knew what had happened. So he told his father. So his father rode out there. This mountain was just acting terrible. It was terrifying. And he rode out there in his boat. And he found the boy just in time. He put him in the boat with him. He said, don't look back. Don't look at the mountain. The mountain was just heaving and writhing and just terrible. And he went back, and because of that, the chiefs told everybody to evacuate, get out of there. So they went up the hillside and up to a neighboring village and got out of there. But they wouldn't let the missionaries' followers go. They had to stay there. And their house was on the sand. That was the only land that they would give the missionary to build on. Singer on the Sand is the name of the book.
I remember the name of that book.
And the next morning, the mountain went up into the air and came crashing down into the water. And the water got sucked back into the ocean. And then it came weeping forward in a tsunami. And it came right to the edge. And the witch doctor had started to leave. But he saw that huge tsunami coming, and he knew he had to get the missionary's child daughter, their daughter, little Marta, because he couldn't bear to lose her. She had touched his heart by playing with the snake that he had put a curse on, and she had survived that, and he just couldn't do without her. So he rushed into the little group that the missionary had singing. They were singing hymns and outside, I think. And the water came up to the island, huge tsunami. And it came and it divided right below the missionary's house. And there was this wall of water on each side that came up around the house and went up the hillside and took out the Islamic teachers who didn't leave either, and they perished, and it sucked them back into the ocean. But the missionary's home was intact. It's an amazing story, and I never forgot that about a volcano erupting completely so that the mountain comes down into the ocean and it's no longer there. I'm not taking this literally. I'm just saying, this is...
No. It's an interesting parallel, because it seems like there's an exclusivity there where it takes those that are on the land out and kills them. Here we see still a third, so we still see some mercy going on here.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting parallel.
It's interesting that John says, and this is typical of John in the Revelation, something like a great mountain.
mm-hmm.
He doesn't say a great mountain. It's something like a great mountain. And he says that a lot all through his visions of Revelation. It's like he sees something and he just can't quite find the words to describe it. So he continually says something like this, something like that.
We say, whatchamacallit. Or thingamajigger, maybe.
So I tried to do a little research on what Ellen White said about the seven trumpets, and I'm limited because I have my little phone and I'm trying to access her books online. But has anybody else found anything where Ellen White comments about the seven trumpets? Because, we were discussing the one third being kind of Satan's trademark, and this symbolically seems to be describing a lot of destruction. And yet we worship the God of creation, not a destroying God. So are these trumpets just announcing, pay attention, a warning? Because sometimes trumpets were used as warnings to say, the enemy is coming in. So anyway, so that question, I couldn't find things, but that doesn't mean they're not there.
Well, I'm looking here. I don't think you're going to find anything that goes blow by blow through the seven trumpets by her.
So.
Which is interesting, isn't it? It's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting that she, when she isn't certain about some passages of scripture, she doesn't comment.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At least I'm assuming maybe she's not certain. She hasn't been that hasn't been revealed to her, I think.
I think when I come to stuff like this that's really vague, again, number one, it's symbology. So I certainly don't jump to saying anything there is literal, which is pretty easy to do on this one. Secondly, it's always going to be linked to other places in the Bible. And a burning mountain, the first thing that comes to mind is Mount Sinai. I mean, the whole thing was burning like a furnace. So it to me, it said it has something to do with that. Thrown into the sea, I actually looked up that word sea, and it's not sea, it's salty water, if that makes any difference. It just simply means salty water. And thrown into, well, there's a whole lot of throwing going on in the vicinity of this. And that's probably significant. A lot of throwing down. Again, you know, without trying to jump to immediate conclusions, which usually ends up with less than satisfying results, I just look at each piece and say, well, what could we find that connects to that piece? And then what can we find that connects to that piece? And you throw all the pieces on the table like a puzzle. And then you start, well, what if we plug this one in here? What if you plugged it in over there? What would this look like? And pretty soon you start seeing a picture.
I just checked and typed in seven trumpets, and she has nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
My Bible has a cross.
I just thought maybe somebody knew something. I didn't.
There's the common denominator here between the angels, which is this trumped word, trumped. And again, in the Hebrew mindset, there's a difference between a shofar and trumpets. So just to make sure that we understand that. But you're right. You go to the common denominator. And so besides that trump, we also have that third, which is like Floyd, you had mentioned, I think that's the Hasatan's trademark. So I'm thinking about this, what Jean had shared with us in that writing that from the other woman from the SDA, the community, and wherein as she's coming, that one is taking what appears to be unrighteous priest or shaman. I don't know what use you were, witch doctors? That what
witch doctor.
You
use? Yeah, that was the
old one. Or shaman or whatnot. And taking them out where we have this third that's being destroyed, which kind of seems opposite. Could this be, which third are we talking about? This is Hasatan's third.
Well, the third of the sea, it's the mountain is only instrumental in causing this. It's not
right. But again, the sea is another, it's another reference to waters, right.
Going into the sea, a third peoples. Of the sea became blood.
Right.
A third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. So you have.
And the third of the ships would refer most likely to, well, I don't want to go too Protestant about it, but most likely the Roman trade, if you
trade.
Will. No?
Trade.
And, yeah, okay. Yeah, I don't want to broad brush that. Sure. Okay.
My Bible has a cross reference for verses 8 and 9 in Jeremiah 51:25. I want to read it. Look, O mighty mountain, destroyer of the earth, I am your enemy, says the Lord. I will raise my fist against you to roll you down from the heights. When I am finished, you will be nothing but a heap of rubble.
And what is the context for this?
Babylon's great punishment is
okay.
So then it has another cross reference to that. Well, wait, let me read 26. You will be desolate forever. Even your stones will never again be used for building. You will be completely wiped out, says the Lord. And then it has Isaiah 13, 19 through 22. And I want to read that too. Babylon, the most glorious of kingdoms, the flower of Chaldean culture, will be devastated like Sodom and Gomorrah when God destroyed them. Babylon will never rise again. Generation after generation will come and go, but the land will never again be lived in. Nomads will refuse to camp there, and the shepherds will not allow their sheep to stay overnight. Wild animals of the desert will move into the ruined city, and the houses will be haunted by howling creatures. Ostriches will live among the ruins, and wild goats will come there to dance, and hyenas will howl in its fortresses, and jackals will make their dens in its places. Babylon's days are numbered. Its time of destruction will soon arrive. That all sounds very
it's all about Babylon.
Apropos to this to me.
So the sea was the region of chaos in the ancient Near East. But it was also the place where ships went to do trading. So you have actually two elements of trade. The ships themselves and the sea they went on to trade. A third of the living creatures in the sea died. That would limit the supply of food.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sounds very economic to me.
Well, Ezekiel 27 is all about ships and economy, which I think is symbolic of Satan's invention of economy. That's what he's all about.
Which he did through, I mean, there was trading that went on for years before Babylon, but the economic system that we have handed down to us from the Babylonians was invented by the Mesopotamians, the early Mesopotamians. So it's interesting that we have this early suggestion of Babylon. Do the cross-referencing. And I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't expecting that at all. But so that Babylon is connected to this economic and trade and all of that, all of the things that made people wealthy. Yeah. And the mountain, the great mountain, would be the symbol of power, I would think. Kingly power or just power that Babylon exerted.
And I think implied here is another factor that's not explicitly stated. But again, I watched a video sometime back about what was going on in Hawaii at that time, you know, when the volcano and the lava flows were pouring down and going into the sea. And when lava hits water, there's some pretty strong reactions. Not the least of which are lethal gases released and eruptions, you know, of water reacting with superheated rock, you know, suddenly. The interaction between those is quite violent and pretty exciting as long as you're not too close to it. And, you know, if it says a great burning mountain is cast into the salt water, there's got to be a reaction. It doesn't just go splash. Something's going to happen.
The animals, the fish, everything, sea creatures and fish are going to lose their lives.
And again, I don't think the thirds should be viewed as a proportion. So, you know, we're thinking, oh, well, that means there was two thirds that weren't. You know, this is symbolic. So, you know, what would the symbolism tell us? Even the symbolism of the ships and the fish?
Well, first of all, it would tell us that Satan was behind it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be destroyed? What, you know, is that an upheaval?
Yeah.
An upheaval in trade, an upheaval in economics, an upheaval in government.
Disruption?
Disruption. even destruction.
Yeah.
And again, when we put this in the context of, you know, the start of Revelation 8, again, this is seems to be, you know, the angels are not sounding until there's this communication between earth and heaven.
Mm-hmm. Between what? Because you
earth and heaven.
Oh.
In context, to me, I just go, God is the creator. He's not the destroyer. So put, I am appreciating what I'm understanding a little bit more. Who's behind this? Is God just saying, pay attention? And what is this disruptive? Because we know that when earthly kingdoms and powers are disrupted, it creates this vacuum for other forces to come in. When everything that what you're used to and how things are supposed to be, when there's that disruption, it is often used by satanic forces, evil forces to come in and step into that vacuum. So I think all this disruption and everybody's saying, well, we need something. And it's this, you know, the man of lawlessness that is soon to be revealed. Is this part of how he ushers in where people are desperate for some kind of stability and for things to get back to, quote, normal? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's really kind of what we're looking at. It's kind of given a kind of mosaic of what this portrays. And I totally think that this is Satan's actions, not God.
Leave to think that.
Yes.
Here's an observation that I glean out of soaking in this for quite a while. And I went back to look at my notes at the beginning of the trumpets here. And without reviewing all my notes, I just sort of have to go by what I wrote down, that I saw the first four trumpets may likely apply to professed God followers, but who become exposed by the heart-searching truths that are released by the trumpets. And then I see a transition that happens with trumpet number five, where the messages are more directly against everyone who dwells on the earth. So these first four trumpets are sort of a different group of, the trumpets are aimed at a certain group of people, and then it transitions to a much larger group. In the last three. And again, this, I still think there's significance in this great burning mountain throne, which I believe alludes to Mount Sinai primarily, although it has other implications. And it's thrown into the sea, which generally in Revelation or prophecy represents peoples. And if these peoples are those who profess to follow God, and if we look at this in a cosmic timeline like we've been experimenting with, you know, Paul talks about that before the law, there was sort of one kind of sin, and the law was given in order to amplify sin. Could it be at least one option is when Mount Sinai was burning in flames and smoke, and the law comes out of that and it's thrown into the ocean of people on earth, and now all of these reactions, you know, are from the law exposing sin exponentially more than it was seen before. And all this chaos among these various entities that are, again, symbolic, has something to do with the law appearing and causing very negative reactions. Does that have any...
I like what you're trying to do. You're trying to thread it. You're threading it forward a little bit. The opposite way. I like what you were bringing in with Ezekiel, because we know the type and the archetype too. So I think there's more of that in that way because they look at this, these traders, they talk about the elders or the men that were of not renown, but forget the word they use, biblios, maybe. I'm not sure. They speak of these men that were part of this trading, which were part of the ports, which were part of it. And they speak of all these areas in the actually in Mediterranean, you know, where they would be looking at these people, this third, and they would be shaking their head. In other words, they would be like not wanting anything to do with them. So I agree. I think, I don't know who said it, but I agree with somebody that this is a shattering of the economic system. And it would go to what you're talking about, the Babylon reward and punishment system.
Let me offer a slant on what you said.
Oh, that's fine.
No, I'm on what Floyd said. I'm sorry. Are you done, though, Bill?
Well, you know, based on what he said.
For now, I am. Yes, go ahead.
You mentioned the burning mountain referring to Babylon. Babylon was all about law, too.
Yes, well, Babylon symbolizes the origin of economics. Because ancient Mesopotamia is where economic systems began. The book that I've mentioned before by Mario Liverani is all about how that began. But I would like to offer something. And that's a little bit of a twist on, and you can throw it out if you don't feel that it fits.
We're throwing everything out to see where it lands.
So here's my two bits. The law was added because of transgression.
That's right.
The law is the law of love. And what happened under Babylonian influence, I think, is that the Jews became preoccupied with law. They not only added to laws to the law, but they made it so complex and so difficult that hardly anybody could keep the laws that they made. And then they held Jesus up to those laws and said, "You're a lawbreaker." I have come to the conclusion, and this is partly based on Margaret Barker, I think it is, a New Testament scholar who did a lot of research on Babylon and discovered through intertestamental literature and other literatures that it's very possible that the Jews in John's gospel are Babylonian Jews who came from Babylon. Because we know that the Babylonian Talmud originated from Babylon, from Jewish people still living in Babylon. And we know that the people coming back from Babylon were not complete. That is, not everybody, not every Jew left Babylon to come home. And so what we have is the possibility that when he talks about the Jews in the Gospel of John, who are the ones who persecute Jesus and the ones who nail him to the cross or have him nailed to the cross, we're talking about old Babylon. Old Jerusalem. And that Babylon is old Jerusalem as in contrast to the new Jerusalem. And that Mount Sinai, yes, exploded with the law, and it was intended to help them understand what love does and what love acts. But instead of accepting it, they turned it into an economic commodity by which they could use to gain favor with God. And favor with God meant you were wealthy.
And wasn't part of the Pharisees and the leaders, their power was because they made up the rules? And it was this kind of power over the people who looked to them to interpret, and unfortunately they interpreted and created things that God never intended, which was exactly why Jesus did not go by their rules, because it distorted the truth about who God was.
Right.
So, Jean, if I understand you right, possibly Sadducees and Pharisees?
Mostly Pharisees were the Babylon. Well, the Sadducees, I don't know that they came directly from Babylon. I don't think the priests did. But everybody was influenced by these Babylonian Jews. They came back later to Jerusalem. They didn't come back when Cyrus was king, and they didn't come back when Darius and Artaxerxes and all those were kings. They came back much, much later, I think, just before Jesus was born, possibly. And they were very influential. And what came out of that influence was the Babylonian Talmud, which there's two Talmuds. There's the Hebrew Talmud and there's the Babylonian Talmud. The Hebrew Talmud comes out of Jerusalem from those who came back from Babylon in the first groups and settled there. Babylonian Talmud comes out of Babylon.
That makes so much sense, because Jesus just railed against those Pharisees. Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath.
With tears in his eyes.
Yeah, I mean, and they've got all these little add-ins and everything. And where did you buy your way into the kingdom?
Well, they had over 400 laws for the cow to keep the Sabbath.
Yeah.
If I'm right, see, this makes so much sense to me, because if you look at my list of parallels or opposites, you have the mark versus the seal. You have the lamb versus the beast, you have, and so on. Well, you have two cities. You have Babylon and you have the New Jerusalem. They're opposites. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? What does that signify? Well, it makes sense if it's Old Jerusalem and the New Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And I'll admit, I stand alone on this. Margaret Barker helped me. Some, I don't agree with everything she came up with, because she uses a method I don't, but I'm planning to do research on it to find out, but it's going to be a while.
So you're not saying New Jerusalem versus Babylon, you're saying New Jerusalem versus Old Jerusalem?
Yeah, that he called that Babylon.
Old Jerusalem being at the time,
because the Babylonian Jews came from Babylon.
Right, but that's more around the time of Christ. That's Old Jerusalem.
It's probably in the years just before Jesus began his ministry. And I'm not sure. You know, I don't have my dates set on that, but I know it's later than.
Well, it's not Jerusalem of David's time. You're talking about a different time.
Right.
So we're talking about the spiritual condition of people in a city, not the location and the buildings.
Right, right.
So the people in Jesus' day were so heavily influenced by Babylonian thinking that was totally woven into the Talmud and all the traditions. And, you know, if you think Ezra and Nehemiah were legalistic, by the time Jesus arrives, they've taken it to a whole new level of legalism.
That's right.
Which makes him entirely unwelcome on earth.
Yeah.
Well, it makes his message near next to impossible to be heard. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting you're using that, because I've always believed there is a very strong understanding and distinction needed between the two Babylons. There's definitely two. And it, coming from a canon background, you have those, the motives of the hills, the city on the hills, as in Rome being on the seven hills as compared to Jerusalem. But it's interesting that you're using that now, because I'm thinking along the lines of the identification or the character of Jerusalem at the time, like 68 AD, and some of the things that had happened regarding the identity of the Jews, because they were losing their identity at that time. The Idumeans were coming in. You had quite a bit of sects, if you will, and a lot of destruction in those last 2 years before the temple
right,
was destroyed. Well,
the city,
you know what I mean? So that makes a lot of sense, because Idumea was no longer on the map after that. I mean, geographically, it was wiped off the map. So I always wondered, what are they doing all those Idumeans? You know,
if you go that route, Revelation 16, which is the last plagues. I'm sorry, the plagues on Babylon. There's a verse that says that Babylon, here it is. And there came flashes of lightning in verse 18, and rumblings, peals of thunder, and a violent earthquake such as not occurred since people were upon the earth. So violent was that earthquake. The great city was split into three parts. The great city is Babylon. It was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell.
Mm.
Now, John is writing Revelation after the fall of Jerusalem, the first fall in AD 70. There's another fall in 135 AD. So there's just pieces of this whole thing that have made more sense to me that he's doing that.
What was that fall in 135? What are you referencing?
I'm not as familiar with that one.
I've never heard of it.
It's the second.
I've never heard of it, but it's interesting because this referencing three parts, which makes sense because we know that there will be a split north to south. But and then the other question I had that jumped in my head, and I don't know, maybe Gene, you could go through it a little bit more, but as that holy city was referenced as Zion with a Z and also with an S. Zion, S-I-O-N. I don't know if that was just translation
I've never heard that. I've only heard with a Z.
Okay.
In 135, Hadrian banished the Jews from Jerusalem and Palestine, razed Jerusalem, and rebuilt the city as Aelia Capitolina, the basis of today's old city, with pagan shrines and the statue of Jupiter placed over the side of Jesus' crucifixion. Now, Jupiter is Roman, but its background, Jupiter is the planet of Marduk, the Babylonian patron god.
God, it's just so satanic.
Yeah, it's Hadrian that did that.
Hadrian? I never even heard of him.
Hadrian was an emperor, I think, wasn't he?
Converted Jew.
Was he?
Yep, married a princess. Pretty interesting guy. But boy, I got to find that because I know there's two spellings of the Jebusite city or whatever, Zion. That's interesting.
Here's another, just a shade that somehow seems like it might fit somewhere in here. And again, if like you said, the Ten Commandments were somewhat intended to reveal what love looks like. Mm-hmm. And yet, pretty much all the history since they hit the ground is legalism. Mm-hmm. So they were hijacked, basically. The whole thing was completely, I think it was hijacked as soon as the throne of Israel said, whatever you say, we'll do it. Mm-hmm. That's slave mentality.
So I'd like to interject something, if I may. The Ten Commandments are not legal. It's not a legal document by ancient Near Eastern standards. There's no penalties. Mm-hmm. The closest you have is the
blessing for the children who obey
them. Yeah, and that can be interpreted as God limiting the consequences, the natural consequences from the third and fourth generation to the third and fourth generation. It's not a legal document. The Book of the Covenant that follows the Ten Commandments is a legal document, and it resembles Hammurabi's laws.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I have a whole book on how similarities and differences between Hammurabi's laws and some of the other Babylonian laws. and the Book of the Covenant. It's quite interesting.
And yet, the very thing that was not a legal document has become the most celebrated, quotes, legal document in all of history.
Yes. No, it's a outline of principles.
Mm-hmm.
This is how you will behave as free people. I brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Therefore, this is how you live as free people. And that's, I get that from Walter Brueggemann. But
it's how God behaves.
Yeah.
So and
if you're reflecting him, then that's what it'll look like. So you know if you're reflecting him or not. If your life looks like this, then you know you're reflecting the right God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that makes me feel better, because I thought this guy had like curly white hair and a big long beard, and
that's what we're supposed to reflect.
That's not what we're supposed to reflect. Sorry. It just doesn't work for me. The man came down from the mountain, and now the mountain's in the sea. What are we going to do with this?
I don't know that we have a solution and an answer for it, but I think it's very helpful to explore everything we can and then leave it laying on the table. I mean, you know, you leave the puzzle sitting there for days while everybody's coming by taking a shot at it.
Right. Well, I've really never done this before, this study of Revelation. So I find it fascinating right now because, well, besides missing last week, but what you got accomplished last week, but you've got 7, 8, 9 and 10, and you've already got three angels already being presented here. So it's kind of like moving fast for me. It's fast paced.
That's well, shall we move on to the third trumpet? Take a week.
Yeah, sometimes we'll have the study on Thursday night and we'll take
it takes me
like one verse
to get through
like,
one verse.
Right. But then again, I get confounded quite a bit. So
I just wanted to make one comment, and this is kind of influenced by Dr. Ken Jennings, and he says how we look at law matters. And if we take the, you know, Babylonian approach or the authority individuals or government takes authority, power over, and then initiates consequences, punishments for breaking of these laws, whereas God's law is reflected of his design, that we love him, and how we love him affects how we treat people. You know, the two great aspects of the law of love to keep in mind, like man's law, that he's the authority sovereign, and then he doles out punishment for breaking his laws instead of seeing them as a reflection of God's design law, how he intends things to function. And to me, that was earth-shattering. And I started looking at, yeah, how have I always looked at law? Different kind of focus. And I think Christianity has been infiltrated with a pagan concept.
They're Babylonian.
I think Judaism or the Israelite community was infiltrated by a pagan concept of God. Yeah. And of his law. And it was originated in Babylonia. Because the Canaanite cultures did not produce laws, so far as we know. They may have had oral laws that they kept, but they never had anything written down, so far as we know. But the Mesopotamians did. And the laws were always done by a sovereign, like you said. And the laws, the thing you do need to know is that Hammurabi's laws were never taken as the last word, and they weren't even used by the judges in determining court cases. They really were more of a reformation of law, an attempt to make a better law that people could read and then say, Hammurabi says. and so it doesn't have quite the power that later law had. And yet it was the beginning of what would happen later. And there does seem to be some mild influence between Babylon and Roman law.
Now, what I see condensing out of this discussion and I'd keep backing up to take a look at this thing, trying to get some perspective, is that if this trumpet is about the abuse of law, and then it mentions three specific things that are affected or involved. There's blood in the sea. Mm-hmm. There's living creatures that die. And then there are ships that are destroyed. You know, what do these three things, again, if this is all symbolic, I think the emphasis that they are living creatures coming from Genesis 1 that are in the sea, and they are, you know, damaged to the point of death. Is there something in the distortion and the abuse and the hijacking of the purpose of law that would cause this kind of damage in these three symbols? And blood, it's like, clearly we have tragically misinterpreted the meaning of blood and, yes, and appeasement models of theology.
Yep.
The living creatures suck the life out of us. You know, all us living creatures in the peoples, you know, this abuse of law has, well, the letter kills, the spirit gives life. And then ships, you know, here's an interesting spin. What are the purpose of ships or boats?
To travel.
To usually for trade.
But think a little simpler. You have to have a boat if you want to get across water.
Transportation.
You don't need water, a boat to travel across land. You only need it in the water. Therefore, the boat is the interference between you and what's not designed for you to walk on, unless it freezes, right? And so the very thing that was designed to help you travel on liquid loses its ability to protect you. And then if I compare that, interestingly, with a couple guys who successfully walked on liquid water, but they did it without a boat. Up. Okay. Is it back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. There was a couple guys in the Bible who successfully walked on liquid water without a boat. And to me, you know, the boat was being swamped. They thought they were going to drown in the boat. When he got out of the boat, he was doing better than in the boat. I don't know. I just think there's some metaphors and some symbolic things and potential here. And it has something to do with the contrast between living by faith or living according to the law.
A slightly different spin on that. When we abuse the law, we abuse people. Mm-hmm. And when we abuse people, we abuse nature.
Hmm.
And so what you're seeing here is, you know, when you view the law as arbitrary, punitive, destructive, you're going to have destruction. That's an overarching.
I was thinking on that destruction, because it says that the ships were destroyed. It doesn't say how they were destroyed. Mm-mm. What if it's the commerce system is what I think it is, and they just don't need a third of the ships, but they do need what the ships represent, which would be supplies.
Also in Ezekiel 27, which is the epitome of commerce,
mm-hmm,
it all ends with the ships sinking.
Yep.
And the merchants are all wailing because the very means of maintaining this whole system have just been swallowed up in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's we think reflected about a third of the water becoming blood, we have these ships that are going to port. Well, if that blood is going, you know, into the ground, which is obviously it's going to pull at these ports are going to be I mean, I'm talking literal, but I mean, they're going to be no longer used for commerce. The system will be the proverbial underpinning, if you will, or the house of cards is falling.
So if you take the plagues, the seven plagues in chapter 16 that fall on Babylon.
Yeah, there's a parallel there with blood.
The third angel poured his bowl, and the second angel poured his bowl into the sea, and it became like the blood of a corpse, and every living thing in the sea died. Instead of a third, now it's every living thing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that is a strong parallel between the trumpet and the bowls. Is in the trumpets, you have a whole bunch of thirds. When you get to the bowls, you get the same symbols, but it's all out.
Right.
I was thinking there were ships as well, but I guess not.
I have some charts where I compared a bunch of these, like the trumpets and the bowls and all these things, and you put them side by side, and a lot of stuff starts jumping out at you when you literally physically put them parallel like that, and you compare them, and you're like, oh, wow, that's a whole lot closer than I thought it was.
Yeah.
I had a thought back to what Gene was talking about law and how it had been distorted, and the Jews were so good at that. And Jesus is just saying, you know, you search the scriptures because in them you think you find eternal life, but they're the ones that talk about me. And why wouldn't Satan attack the law? It's, first of all, a reflection of God's character. Second, according to Galatians 3:24, it was meant to be our teacher, to lead us to Christ. That's the purpose of the law. So why wouldn't Satan attack it or screw it all up? Because the people who killed Jesus, all right, they were Adventists with no defiled food in their stomach, no gluten, no dairy. I don't know what else they didn't do, but probably no Asperger's too. But they were Sabbath keeping people, tithe keeping people. They knew how to do the law better than anyone, and they rush home to get ready for Sabbath after they killed Jesus. You know, it's just the epitome of law keeping. I mean, it's lawlessness. It's just ridiculous. I think the enemy has attacked law, uh-huh. especially God's law.
He's also created a counterfeit of law.
That's right. It. Exactly.
The artificial enforced law.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's interesting because all of that verse 24, Galatians 6, 3:24, the law was meant to lead us to Christ that we might be justified or set right by what? Trust.
Trust.
Mm-hmm. By relationship. The mm-hmm. law was never intended to be there. It was just a schoolmaster to lead us to a relationship. And that's what was broken. That's the definition of sin, a broken relationship, broken trust. So it's got to be restored, and it can't happen through some legal, arbitrary measure.
So is that the prologue to the new song?
You got to get hungry before you're ready to eat good food.
Table's being set as we speak.
The law was given to show you how empty you were, so you would want something better. Just like Laodicea. If you're clueless that you're miserable and poor, blind and naked, mm-hmm. if you're clueless, you got no incentive to do anything.
Mm-hmm. And again, I like what Jennings says about the law. It's like an MRI. MRIs don't fix things, but they point out things that need to be healed.
Diagnostic tool.
So it's, if you use mm-hmm. the law as a diagnostic tool, that helps you see, man, I need healing, and you go to the healer. Mm-hmm. Not but to the MRI, but to the healer.
But if you take the diagnosis that it produces and you say, that is who you are, mm-hmm. that is your identity, you just created hopeless despair.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
I think instead of saying, this is your condition, this is saying, this is who you are organically, and there's nothing you can do about it. Mm-hmm. And that's how the law is abused, because then it brings condemnation instead of information.
Well, for those of us born into sin, right. But for Satan, who chose to, in the presence of God's glory and full understanding, he may be the one exception to that.
Well, shall we go on, or do you want to discuss this a little further?
I think if you open up with the next verse, it's going to be discussed further for certain, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Well, that one throws me almost as much as Romans 1:28 through 32 does. So, you know, I'd like to get my head around it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who would like to read verses 10? Actually, verses 10 and 11.
I'll read it if you want.
Okay.
If I don't break up, am I breaking up?
No.
All right. This is Revelation 8, verses 10 and 11 from Free Bible Version. The third angel blew his trumpet. A great star fell from heaven, blazing brightly. It fell on earth, a third of the rivers and springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood, and one third of the water turned bitter, and many people died from drinking the water because it had become poisonous.
Is wormwood mentioned anywhere else in the Bible?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
I was thinking somewhere in the Old Testament.
The water, Mara, something bitter.
With bitter?
Bitter. I don't know. That comes to mind with the bitter water, but I don't know if
it is. But it doesn't say wormwood there.
No, it's a different, but it's supposed to mean the same. So I'm just trying to go, where else does it say bitter?
Deuteronomy 29:18 talks about wormwood. Proverbs 5:4, Jeremiah 9:15, Jeremiah 23:15, Lamentations 3:15 and 19, and Amos 5:7.
Can you have that list? Can you send that? I'd love to research that. I wasn't writing.
Let me copy it here and stick it into the chat. There you go. And I think you can click somewhere in the chat and download the chat at any time.
Thank you.
So you don't lose it.
Thank you, Floyd.
So in that you have the wormwood, small w, paired with gall, right? Which is kind of interesting. But it's that big wormwood, a star called wormwood.
Yeah, it involves bitterness.
It sure does. Well, the word wormwood, I believe, in the Hebrew means calamity. But I'm not sure about that. There's a few takes on that. But I just find it extremely interesting in the selectivity of it, that it only strikes at a certain portion, you know, a third part of the rivers. That's why I really don't think we could look at this at all, literally, at all.
Right.
It's just too hard to say. I mean, we could wax soliloquies like till the cows come home, but I don't know how you would be able to hang the cowbell on this one at all. Seriously.
You know, literal wormwood, at least what I've seen in carpentry, is
right.
It's riddled with wormholes.
Yep. Which is much desired by a lot of people, believe it or not.
Yes, it's quite
decorative. You know, with fatiguing furniture. Very, very much desired. Architecturally, I should say. You know,
but if it's wormholes that are made by termites,
not so good.
Not real desirable.
Right.
Some Some of the wood in pine is called pecky cedar or pecky cedar wood, and it has all the wormholes in it. But it is decorative. All beauty's in the eyes of the beholder, I guess.
Right.
So, but what we're identifying is the huge star, which of course would be a reference to Satan, right? That fell, burning, fell from the sky. And the impact of that is death.
That would be the most common thing that my mind would go to. Sure. Sure.
Yeah, because water is essential for life. And so people who drink this are poisoned. So it just makes, again, Satan is revealed for who he is, the deceiver who wants to destroy.
Now, we started out in the previous trumpet with a mountain, a great mountain, and great seems to always be applying to Satan in Revelation. A great mountain that's burning. And then in this trumpet, we have a star that's burning.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It just got Satan's trademarks all over the place here.
Yeah, I think so too. Yes.
I'm just going to read a note that I put under this wormwood one that is sort of jumping to the end of one interpretation I came up with, again, because it's spiritual. Satan perverts the gospel into a system of merit and works that results in bitterness and death. Wormwood is wood riddled with wormholes that make it weak. A weakened star spreads its own weakness, contaminating waters and people, which are the same thing, with the same infection that he has. And I pose a question, could social media and entertainment in our day be a primary means of weakening and debilitating many, setting them up for spiritual and even physical death? You know, like filling us full of holes, our brain full of holes from all the social media. Similarly, religious beliefs that promote mixtures of good and evil undermine the spiritual strength of many people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can certainly say that just from observation. I teach a class called Thrive. It's required of all freshmen. And one of the things I have them do twice is they take a Sabbath, and starting at sundown on Friday, they put away all digital media. And the only way they can use it through the Sabbath hours is if they call their parents. I do let them do that. These are freshmen. They can't handle being away from mom and dad on Sabbath. So I let them call their parents. But the rest, they have to fast from it for 24 hours. And then they have to write up an essay answering some questions about that, about what the results were. And so many students will tell you that they sleep better, they're less anxious, because the social media for them is a way to tell whether they are doing all the right things.
Yeah,
it's a legalism all its own.
Uh-huh.
And for the first time, I've taught this class now for several years, and for the first time, I had a student refuse to do that assignment. And the reason was, he was so addicted to computer games that he couldn't do without his computer, even on Sabbath. And my heart goes out to this generation, because they're in a vice that is so gripping. Mm-hmm. That I asked him to get help. I feel like he needs a detox center or something like that. But this generation is more affected by it than any previous generation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I was looking at Deuteronomy 29:18. It says, it may be that there is among you a man or a woman or a family or tribe whose heart is already turning away from the Lord our God to serve the gods of those nations. It may be that there is among you a sprout a root sprouting poisonous and bitter growth. That's the worm.
And that goes right back to James talking about, or no, in Hebrews, you know, where Esau, when I think it refers, or it's in links with Esau, where a root of bitterness springing up poisons many around us.
Mm-hmm. Every time we deal with a works-oriented lifestyle, and I maintain that we have long as a society earned our value by our works.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Performance-based identity.
So we talk about how much is a person worth, meaning economically, mm-hmm. or what you need to do to be valuable. I like these texts. I want to look all of them up. But I think that every time we meet a works-oriented facility of anything, we are meeting paganism. Mm-hmm. Again. Every false religion. Mm-hmm. It's a religion of works. Mm-hmm. And instead of a relationship of love and trust.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when Brother Floyd mentioned literal translations of wormwood, he thought perhaps. Anyway, I remember that the Ukraine Chernobyl was associated with wormwood. Do any of you recall that?
Hmm. You mean Chernobyl, the place that had an accident?
Yes.
In the 1970s or 80s?
Yeah, and I think they have a memorial in the site. Russian, the word Chernobyl is Russian for wormwood. So they associated that with some biblical scholars or people who went into prophecy, said that this was the wormwood, that the great wormwood being talked about. But I really can't recall much more.
What interests me is, and of course this has been mentioned already, but this great star is named Wormwood. We wouldn't think of a star with light being named Wormwood. But what Satan did in heaven was to create Wormwood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so much of the questions that Satan brought up there was how God uses power. Mm-hmm. And I think one of his most effective ways to poison minds is a misunderstanding of how God uses his power. Because God uses his power, as Jesus says, authority has been given to me. And then he proceeded to wash 12 pairs of dirty feet. Mm-hmm. You know, I know who I am. And so God serves and cares for and selflessly gives, where, you know, when you see media presentations of the good guys and the bad guys, it's always about power. It is not about serving. It's not about loving. It ultimately, who has the most power over? And that's, you know, that's the God that's still accepted in so much of Christianity is,
yes, God, sovereignty God of God.
Or to destroy. Like the good guys, they use their power to destroy. And I think that's one of his most effective ways of poisoning our minds. If we worship that kind of God, we become like that kind of a God. Mm-hmm. And I think of the study in Rwanda where they said, what was the difference between those who killed and those who tried to save and protect? And it was across the board their view of God. If they if they worshiped an authoritarian power over God, they killed. If they worshiped a loving, caring, protective God, they saved.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question. Well, I have several questions, but I'm going to limit it to this one. In this, what I see is I see the angels sounding, but there's no direct causation there.
Right.
I don't see the angels being responsible at all for it. It just, and then this happened.
An announcement.
Yeah, like an announcement. But then I also think of the heart of the Father who created everything, all of it. It's all his. Nothing we can give him. So this star that they talk about, he had to allow this.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense. So I'm looking at that going, wow, this is really, I'll just use the word, you know, from the background, tactical. This is very tactical.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, this is extremely tactical. This is not something that, you know, this is not something of, you know, front lines. This is not a foxhole move at all. And I just find it very, very interesting that that it falls and they became wormwood. So I don't know what that looks like. I gotta drop this. I got this terrible, terrible, literal thing going on. I just got to get rid of it. And it's like you say, Flood, you got to look. It's almost like reading between the black and white here.
Yeah.
Where you got to look at this and go, it became wormwood. It became calamity. You don't have to get all, you know, hung up about, you know, two clicks and four things down, you know, at 600 yards. It's not that at all. It proceeds from this. In other words, and then it happens like an announcement, and then it happens, and an announcement, and then it happens. Very interesting.
William, I'm thinking about your question, and a question comes to my mind to possibly put into perspective of yours. And that is, how is God dealing with the problem of sin that has entered his universe? And that may not seem related to yours on the surface level.
If he allows it to happen, it's not like he's saying, go ahead and do it, but at the same time, it's just the power of the ability here is amazing to me. And then it says, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. He didn't make man bitter.
Right. Right.
Well, you know, so what's going on here is, you know, and maybe I got that third part stuck in my head from Floyd. I don't know. But this battle,
I think the star is definitely Satan.
Yeah. In the battle, which it just appears like John's trying to say, look, this is a real battle. I mean, this is, you know, this is not something I'm just, you know, in my, I don't know, when he wrote it, maybe 90s, whatever. You know, this is not just something some, you know, my house in days. I'm just writing this just to kind of like make up the story. This is a real, real battle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is real blood.
Mm-hmm.
And this is real land, and it's real mountains, and it's getting real to me.
I think it's interesting when I think back to our discussion of the seals and some of the confusion about the rider on the white horse. It got clearer the more you read on who was this guy who initially could be mistaken for good, and the conclusion was this is not God. And in the same way, as we look at these trumpets, as we continue to progress, it's becoming clearer here who's actually being revealed,
mm-hmm.
and who's up to their destructive ways. And it is not God being destructive. And, you know, the one thirds, and now we see the star falling from heaven, and what's coming next, and the next three, when you get to, you know, when you cover all seven. So it's just interesting to me. God continues to reveal. Read on. When you're confused, read on. Right.
And he jumps, and this jumps back a little bit too, because I'm looking at the bitter waters. And that, I mean, if you look at bitter waters in Hebrew context, it's very interesting. I mean, it touches on a lot of things. It says men. I don't look at that as being, you know, gender based at all, but the fact that he have the men with the bitter waters, that kind of just Like I said, it almost seems tactical to me. These words are very, very interesting to me.
Would you like to take a look at the chart that I put together?
Sure.
Let me just go ahead and stick it up here. Can you see it?
Yeah, now I can. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Floyd.
Okay. And I may have sent this out already, didn't I? Like a couple months ago or something?
I think some time ago I sent it out.
Yeah. But, you know, you look at these comparisons, particularly the trumpets and the bowls, and it's striking. You know, the earth is the common denominator here. Then the next one, you know, the burning mountain thrown into the sea, and it's poured, the bowl is poured into the sea. It became blood. Every living thing died. A third of the creatures died. And you can't miss the parallel. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. just so vivid that you're like, okay, this was planned this way. And just a comment on what William was saying is I see Revelation progressively exposing more and more thoroughly the diabolical characteristics of the enemy, of the dragon, of the beast, of everyone who follows that pattern. It increasingly becomes more and more obvious and more evil. And you see that when you compare these, you know, it just gets worse and worse. And it has to happen that way.
Yeah. Because that counterfeit is coming very front and forward to me as well.
And the only way God can win is not by counterforce, but by revelation. That's why it's called the revelation of Jesus Christ. Because only through revealing the truth, you know, that's how judgment happens. Light comes, and our reaction to the light establishes what side we've chosen to be on. And the whole book of Revelation is this progressive revelation of both the truth about God in the Lamb and the truth about the dragon through the beast and all the other evil characters in here.
When Jesus died on the cross, he had those same two things. He revealed that the Father didn't kill him and he isn't going to be killing us, mm-hmm. but also exposed that the nature of sin is that it would kill even God if God let it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the fact that this bitterness is there, I mean, bitterness, man, that's the quickest that I know of. That's the quickest way to death. To hold bitterness or resentment. This is getting real, you know, very real to me.
Well, I'd like to pull into the lives that we have to live in the midst of duress.
Mm-hmm.
Our temptation will someday be that we want God to use some measure of force to put our to take care of our enemies.
Yep.
Right. Did you say duress?
Duress, yes.
Do you understand in the legal system, duress is a perfunctory defense that forces the judge to take your position. So if you are in a defensive position, in other words,
a defendant,
if you answer to the court that you're under duress, immediately the judge has to take your position.
I was using it in a non-legal sense that
I understand, but I also look at it as Father being a righteous judge.
Anyway, what I have learned is that's the big temptation, is to want God in some way to stand up to the enemy, who we know to be Satan, mm-hmm. and to deal with him and all his followers. And that that's when we really come to know him mm-hmm. as he really is when we realize that he will not use force. Yeah. He will not use those measures that we mm-hmm. tend to think of, because, you know, that God always acts in ways that are good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He created in love. He created in love. Love, the law of love is the law of life.
Yeah.
And he can only act what is in what is good. Mm-hmm. And whereas Satan can pretend to be good, mm-hmm. but his actions always lead to evil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just think that this can get so real, as William was saying, because as we experience a time of complete persecution, we're going to learn a lot about our own temptations mm-hmm. and how we're weak where God is strong.
Mm-hmm. And will I reject?
Have to completely trust in him.
And will I do like the Jews did, reject Jesus because he didn't fit my power?
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's not until you suffer that that it becomes clear that you have that weakness.
And it's really tough for us, for our nature, to be willing to believe Jesus when he says, my power is made perfect in weakness.
Your weakness.
Mm-hmm. And we're like, I don't like that. I was hoping
I want to be
some other kind of power here.
I want to be strong. I want to be powerful. No. We have to give that up.
But that weakness is the very epitome of the symbol of the hero of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How many wars are won through losing your life? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jesus seems to be the first one.
And and those who lose their lives for his sake.
Right. Yes. Exactly.
Discover them.
Yeah.
And referencing Revelation 12:11, which we've talked about before, but they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, by the mm-hmm. word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives so much that they were afraid to die. So,
they were not afraid.
That sounds a little different than the souls of those who had been martyred under the altar crying out. Something happens to our view of God that changes the core of who we are with that desire for vengeance or power over or retribution, because we're so acquainted with God that we follow the Lamb.
Right.
So in many ways, it sounds like God is just the biggest risk taker in the whole universe. And gives Satan entirely freedom, his arch enemy, complete freedom.
That's why we suffer.
To kill him, to kill himself, to kill him, that Satan's creator, I mean, not Satan, but Lucifer's creator, okay? Satan invented himself. So I give him credit for that. But here the God who has all the power, the authority, but he has more freedom and love than anyone understands, and they just don't get it. And it seems so foreign, it almost seems too good to be real, because nobody treats their enemies that way and wins, except Jesus.
Because we, it's our definition of what it means to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It's what our definition is of overcoming. We thought it was overcoming our enemies. Overcoming is about overcoming ourselves, not our enemies. Mm-hmm.
And my hang-up of what is right or what is just gets to be retributive instead of restorative.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got the wrong heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why that biblical principle becomes so important. You become like the God you worship.
Mm-hmm.
Until you have a God that is not a monster God, a God that is full of compassion, mm-hmm. full of love, not willing that any should perish, but gives absolute freedom even to all his enemies, loves everyone always, period. You got the wrong one.
Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like we came to a kind of consensus here
mm-hmm.
for these verses. And it's true that Satan's kingdom is one of total bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
He is a bitter.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very bitter.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say then that bitterness is the opposite of love?
It's the result of the opposite of love. The opposite of love would be hate. but bitterness is the derivative of hate.
Yeah, so if you lose family or whatnot, you know, it can cause you to be bitter. If, you know, if there's a head-on accident, whatever it might be. That's why he says to pray. Mm-hmm. And to pray for them. I mean, to pray for those, you know. That's pretty powerful, you know. If you're to lose a family and pray for the person responsible for it, you know. You don't know the circumstances. But I also find it very interesting with this wormwood that it kind of goes back to, I don't know how many weeks ago when you all were talking about the incense, you know, because it kind of gives me the feeling like this light, this wormwood, whatever it is, kind of had like, you know, could this be like Lucifer's light that he's finally done with? You know, he can't do with it anything with it, so he's going to throw it to the earth.
Counterfeit incense.
And use
it's it. Like counterfeit incense. It's like, you know, it's like, yeah, it's like, so now those prayers that we know, which can be looked at as innocence, you know, all of that just becomes a stink in the nose. It's just, no, thank you. You know, this is it. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's a real turning point to me. Pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
That's good, William. Thanks for sharing. That word counterfeit, Floyd, I heard you introduce. I think the devil has a counterfeit God for every one of us. Mm-hmm. And I have to ask, what is mine? What's the one he's trying to get me to believe in? And what lies am I believing about? Who is God or what is God? And is it too good to be real, as Satan wants me to believe, about the real God?
What I'm constantly challenged with increasingly in all this exposure I'm getting from multiple Zoom calls that I have a week that are all God's orchestrating all this stuff. And sometimes I feel almost overwhelmed with all this information, which I've been learning for the last few years, that is so compelling and convincing. And yet what I'm challenged is, how do I get my heart to believe this? Because I know all too well that my heart does not believe what my head believes.
Yeah.
And it's my heart that's going to make the difference in a crisis, not the information I know.
Yes.
Yeah. And I just have to plead with God, do whatever it takes to get this into my heart level. Because it's not enough to just know the answers. It's just not enough. I know it's not enough.
For me, what the answer to that prayer means always means suffering.
Probably so.
Because it's in suffering that I get my heart opened and I see what's in it. And I see better how that has to change. And then I can allow the Spirit to change it.
And we call it all joy, right?
That's the formula to meet it with, yes.
A new song.
Yeah, the new song is the antidote, that's for sure. I was just thinking that bitterness could be the opposite of forgiveness.
Yeah. It could be. Bitterness and resentment go together.
Mm-hmm. Because when you don't forgive, you become bitter.
Mm-hmm. I worked with a lot of abused women doing trauma therapy. And I had benefited by listening to wise people say, when you hold on to the worst moments in your life, you're the one that's continually affected. And so forgiveness frees you up from that focus. And that's why God says forgive, because he doesn't want us to go over that trauma in our mind over and over and over, because it changes us.
Right.
You become wormwood.
So, yeah, we become bitter, fearful, bitter, revengeful. Anyway.
Even irrational.
Yeah.
And it destroys your capacity for relationships with anybody. Except to commiserate with people that want to commiserate with you.
Keeps you stuck.
Yeah.
Not moving forward.
You get to know more about worry, anxiety, and fear, separation. What else?
Yeah, it just keeps backwards instead of forward moving. So God's ways do work. Bring peace, joy, happiness, release.
Comfort. There you go. The right comfort.
So next week gets a little heavier.
The third of the sun and a third of the moon and the third of the stars.
Yeah, that gets even more involved.
All sources of light.
Well, I can see it going different directions, that's for sure. Yeah. There's different options.
Well, we can get started on it. We can get started on it after we hang out.
This is called cosmic. How do you say it? Colloquy? Is that correct?
Cosmic. Oh, you mean colloquy. Where the, yeah.
How do you say it? Is it colloquy?
Colloquy.
Colloquy? Thank you.
Colloquy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, this is going to be a tough one, considering all the power that's coming forward. So I trust that you all have a very interesting perspective on this. Can you suggest where I might brush up on my what is it called? Cosmetology?
The Bible.
Maybe I need to get a haircut. I'm going to go get a haircut. That's it.
Cosmology.
I'm sorry. I'm just making fun. That's all. I told you I'm working on my sense of humor. I know he has one.
There you go. That's great.
Just a characteristic. I'm trying to work on it. But I digress.
Well, I don't have all the answers. But I'd love to get more in tune with the spirit and what he's going to try and teach me through it.
As we all.
It's interesting. I had a conversation with a group of women that we've been connecting with for over 20 years now. And we were talking about the word mysterion. And I said, I don't agree with this author's use of mystery, which was beyond reason.
Mystic.
Senses. She was talking about mystic. I said, so I started looking at all the verses in the Bible, some at least, that talk about mystery. And it's so cool. So far in my study, God always links that to revealing or the plan to reveal or to make those connections to the back promises that weren't clear until, you know, something happens that makes the past clear. And I go, the God I worship is a God who wants to reveal. Mm-hmm. He's not into secrets and hiding things. He's the God who wants to bring
to
light
known.
What is truth. So we're not, you know, we're not caught off guard.
I will be found by you.
I just said, God
I
reveals.
Have made you known.
Yeah. He wants me to understand and make all these connections. So thanks to you all for making some connections that were not here before today. So thank you. Yeah.
For everybody's thank you input. For your part too. I just have to say that the biblical view of mystery is so opposite to the Greco-Roman and Babylonian views of mystery.
Yeah.
Mystery does mean without reason, without sharing. It's secret, always secret.
Yeah.
It's not, really the. Doesn't it break the connection between cause and effect? It turns it into arbitrary.
Well, certainly magic does.
Magic does, yeah. Mm-hmm. And magic creates mystery.
Yeah. Functions by magic in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there a religion centered around mysticism?
Yes, the mystery religions of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
But the more I study Babylon, the more magic is everywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's a really pseudo way of living, a pseudo reality.
Mm-hmm. Pseudo or counterfeit.
Devil
fake. Work.
I like to say fake.
Yeah, right.
But that's what the whole law system is, because the punishments meted out by laws seldom has anything to do with what the law is talking about. It's completely arbitrary, completely artificial. There's no natural cause and effect whatsoever. It's all a mystery to some extent. It's just, you know, whatever the person who made the law is, well, you know, he said, the throne of iniquity works mischief by law.
Yeah.
Sounds like you're talking about the penal substitution model of salvation.
Yeah. Flat out, yes.
In Chicago, we call that three-card Monte. You know what that is?
No.
Three-card Monte is a game that they play on the street in Chicago. They take a card, and they make one of the cards Monte. And then they take bets, and they move the cards around on the table. And you got to guess which one is the Monte. So it is that magic that you're talking about. It's sleight of the hand. It's magician. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people that would tell you that they know how to play it. They know how to play it. But it's trickery because it's sleight of the hand. And it just, it's the way it's going to be. It's just the way it's going to be. It's going to be trickery.
Well,
and it's a lot easier just to say, hey, I won't be deceived. I have a promise that I won't be deceived. That's how I say, I'm sure, I'm sure, I'm sure. But doubt is going to come in. There's no doubt.
Have we decided to adjourn, shall we say?
Yeah, I think that's good.
We've done 2 hours.
We've done 2 hours, yeah.
You mean there's no, they're not going to be a rabbit out of the hat yet? What?
There's a time for everything, a time to begin and a time to end.
On the Babylonian trail.
William, I have some words for you.
Go west, young man. Go west.
You can begin your anticipation of all that's in store for next week.
Oh, boy.
Okay. Why don't we have closing prayer? Gracious Father, we thank you so much for the time we've had together today. Mm-hmm. We thank you for your Spirit's presence and for guiding us into seeing all the richness of the Bible. We ask that you will continue to lead us and guide us as we continue our study. Be with us this coming week and enable us to accomplish the things that you would have us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.